Okay. Good morning, everyone. This is my first time in this meeting room up here. I've been to the WTO a few times, but I've never been to the third floor. So I can imagine some people will come in while we're going along, but that is, I guess, par for the course for a typical Geneva meeting.
And a 9 o'clock start.
So I applaud all of you. One of the things about having a room that's very difficult to find is that it becomes a filtering process. Only the intelligent people show up at the meeting. So I'm very happy we have quality over quantity. My name is Anthony Miller. I'm from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD. There I am the focal point on corporate social responsibility in the Investment Enterprise Division. I'll be moderating the panel today. My director, James Zahn, sends his regrets. He was called away at some last-minute duties. Today, we are going to talk about export processing zones and sustainable development. I would ask you all to close your eyes for a visualization experiment, except it's very early in the morning, and I'm afraid you might fall asleep, so I won't do that. But what I would say is that when I say the words export processing zone, what is it that you see in your mind? What headlines do you see in your mind from newspapers or magazines and so on? Export processing zones, when we think about social and environmental issues, have a very bad reputation. There's been a lot of headlines and critiques about lower labor standards, lower environmental standards, and all kinds of horrific practices taking place in these zones. So today, what we're going to discuss is a different vision for what these zones could be. We're not talking necessarily about what these zones are, although we will cover some of that, but we're talking about what these zones could be. So as we talk about the zones and we talk about what they can do in the area of social and environmental issues, I just wanted to put that right up front, so that you don't think that we're naive and that we have no clue what's going on in the world of export processing zones. So we're looking at the what could be, not necessarily what currently is. Today, we're going to be discussing an ongoing research project that UNCTAD is looking at on export processing zones and their contribution to the Sustainable Development Goals. We are going to absorb the feedback of this discussion. I've been to this public forum before, and I have to say I applaud the WTO for holding these public forums. I find them very interesting and interactive, and I hope that will be the case today. So I encourage all of you to jump in. We will keep the interventions from the panel to not more than half the time, so we have at least half the time to hear from you, because that's what I'm most interested in hearing about. So if you have comments about this topic, we can absorb that into the paper that we're working on and that we will be publishing soon. So what we work on at UNCTAD is about investment trends and their contribution to sustainable development. One of the things we have noticed across this field is a new generation of investment policies that are much more focused and linked to sustainable development. If you look at investment policies back in the 1990s, this sort of first generation, they were really all just about the investors' rights, companies' rights, and so on. You're just attracting investment in any way possible. Now there are people trying to balance that a little bit. It's absolutely necessary to attract investment to spur trade and commerce, to create jobs, but not at any price. The ILO is often will point out is that it's not just about jobs, it's about decent jobs, good jobs. And the same thing we can say about environmental protection and so on. The other broader context is the growing pressure on multinational enterprises to engage in good practices of corporate social responsibility. And not only on multinational enterprises, but multinational enterprises themselves, as they start to introduce their own codes of conduct, they start to put pressure on their value chain, their suppliers around the world. And that becomes very difficult for them, of course, to implement the further they go down their value chain in very complex global chains. What we talk about in this research project and what we're looking at and exploring is the idea that you could take export processing zones and transform them into a zone of sustainable processing, a zone of sustainable business excellence. That instead of the sales pitch of the zone officials being that we offer cheap, and no standards, the sales pitch can be that we offer cost-effective implementation of responsible business practices. If you source from a supplier in our zone, your company is not going to end up on a headline because of some horrific accident. We will help you to maintain good standards. So this is the idea that we're exploring. We have a panel with us today that's going to go into a lot more detail, so I'm not going to talk much longer. We're going to start first with my colleague Raul Torres from the WTO. We're very fortunate to have him with us. He's an expert on free zones, and he can explain to us the bigger context about WTO rules and free trade zones, because the WTO rules are changing and they are having an impact on the future of zones. And this is something very current. You have certain clauses and exemptions and so on that will expire in the next few months. So it is a very current topic. After that, I'm going to ask Professor Jim Bendel, who's been a contributor to this research project that we're working on, who knows it in depth, to go a little bit more of a deep dive into our own research and explain some of what we found so far, what we're looking at, what we're considering. And then I'm going to ask our two expert discussants here from the ILO and from civil society, from Cuts International, to give us their thoughts about this. We're very pleased to have with us the executive director of Cuts International from India, who India is a country that has a large number of export processing zones or free zones or so on. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Raul Torres. You have the floor.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for inviting me to this panel, and I look forward to reading that report and the results of your research, which sounds extremely interesting. And it goes along the way of what the WTO has been generally saying about free zones, is that yes, free zones are affected by WTO rules, and in many cases that can be considered as a WTO prohibited subsidy, but that's not necessarily the case, and free zones can be made WTO compatible, and the attractiveness of free zones does not just lie in the incentives of fiscal nature that you may be able to grant in this free zones, but also other sorts of incentives and the kind of incentives that you have just mentioned about having a contained area where corporate social responsibility standards can be easily evaluated and enforced can be one of those other incentives that keep zones relevant and attractive for FDI and as a pole of development in the country. So how exactly do WTO rules affect free zones? Well, first of all, I have to say that the WTO has no view on free zones as an industrial policy instrument. So we're completely neutral on their use. And also, the free zones are not directly regulated by any agreement in the WTO. However, there are several agreements in the WTO that do affect the operations of free zones and how they are set up. Of them, of course, the one that is most affecting the free zones is the SCM agreement, the Subsidies and Countervailing Measures Agreement, but also the TRIMS agreement, the Agreement on Trade-Related Investment Measures. The GATS itself also affects free zones because commitments that you make under the GATS would also affect the free zones. And now, of course, we have the tree facilitation agreement, and free zones can become an excellent pilot to test some of those tree facilitation measures. And one other thing that I have to say at the outset is that no free zone has ever been challenged in WTO dispute settlement. So that's a little bit of an unusual situation, given the large amount of free zones that you have out there. So there are several explanations why this is so. One explanation is that, you know, that the treatment of free zones, as you will see, is quite a complex issue under the agreements. And another explanation is basically the glasshouse effect. Everybody has a free zone, so nobody wants to start challenging them left and right. We did have a couple of years ago that the special economic zones in China were questioned or were the subject of some consultations under the dispute settlement mechanism. But however, those consultations did not result in the establishment of a panel. So let me give a brief reminder of what are the rules on subsidies, because these are the ones that most affect the free zones. First of all, a subsidy in the WTO is defined as a financial contribution, and this is an important element, by the government that confers a benefit to the recipient. And for those subsidies to be subject to the disciplines of the agreement, they have to be specific. but as we'll see, most of the incentives that you provide in free zones more or less can comply with this with these requirements or fall within that definition. Now, then the agreement also divides these subsidies into two categories. One is the prohibited subsidies, and the other one is the actionable subsidies. So prohibited subsidies are, on the one hand, export subsidies, so those subsidies that are contingent upon export performance, and on the other hand, import substitution subsidies. So these are the subsidies that the agreement considers that they are more distortive of trade, so therefore the disciplines that govern them are the more strict, and there's a prohibition on them, actually. The other category of subsidies is all other subsidies which cause adverse effects. So basically, the stand of the WTO on this issue is that, or the agreement on this, of this issue of the members, is that domestic production subsidies are allowed, provided that they do not cause trade distortions. And if they cause trade distortions, then they are open for other members to challenge them. But they have to show that those adverse effects, those effects on trade exist. So which are those adverse effects? First, nullification and impairment of a WTO benefit, injury to a domestic industry, and serious prejudice. And serious prejudice is four situations which, among other things, allow countries to challenge subsidies that are having effects on the markets that they are competing with them. For example, if a subsidy is causing displacement or impedance of another country's exports to a third country, then that country who has seen its exports being unfairly competed in this third country market can challenge those subsidies in the WTO. So what can WTO members do about these subsidies? Well, as I was saying, prohibited subsidies, they are the ones who are more strictly regulated, so they can be challenged in the WTO dispute settlement mechanism. The panel will be set up to judge on the issue, and the country that is challenging the subsidy only has to show that this is a subsidy that is either contingent upon exports or contingent upon the substitution of imported products over domestic products or the substitution of those imports. And the effects of this subsidy of this panel would be that it will call for the withdrawal of the subsidy. In the case of actionable subsidies, also you can set up a panel to judge on the issue, but they will have to, the country that is challenging will have to show that this subsidy causes adverse effects. And the result of the case, if it's successful, is that the panel will ask for the withdrawal of the subsidy or the removal of the adverse effects. And in both cases, these subsidies are open for members to or exposed to members imposing countervailing duties. So these are unilateral measures that members may take to counter the effect of subsidies that are causing injury to their domestic industry. So how does these rules apply strictly to the issue of free zones? And this is what we're going to see right here in a little bit of a graphic and as abstract way. So a free zone is usually a delimited geographical area within the national customs territory of a country where you will be granting a certain amount of benefits conditioned upon certain other elements that the companies in the free zones and the free zones themselves must comply. So usually the main component of these free zones is that any imports coming into them will be duty-free, so no import duties on this on these zones. And this the goods made in these free zones are usually exported also without any limitation or without any duties. However, in many cases, if these goods that are produced in this free zones enter the customs territory of the country, then they have to repay those taxes that they were exempted from. So what are some of the conditions for the establishment of these free zones? First of all, you have, of course, as I said, that they are delimited geographical areas. They are sometimes fenced in areas within cities, or sometimes even the whole city could be declared a free zone. But generally, they have some kind of geographical limitation where the benefits would only be applicable to those companies that are within these areas. Another condition is that many of the countries will be, many of the companies will be subject to authorization and licensing, either of the whole free zone or of the whole operation, and of the companies that are within that free zone as well. Another element here is that they may be subject to some exporting requirements. They may be one of the conditions is that, for example, the company has to export at least 60% of their production in order for it to be able to enjoy the benefits of the free zone. Another element is performance requirements, and this usually translate into, for example, having to that production in the zone will have a certain minimal local content requirement. And another element that, as I said, is that there may be some restrictions of sales into the national customs territory. This can either be quantitative in nature, so you could only sell, let's say, 10% of your production back into the national customs territory, or they could be in the form of the tax repayment of those taxes that were exempted from in the free zones. So, what are the benefits that that these companies in the free zones enjoy? Well, most of them are an exemption of import duties, we already saw, and this includes an exemption of the import duties on capital goods or productive assets, the exemption of direct taxes on the produce or on the revenues of the that are produced in the free zones, an exception on indirect taxes as well, so sales taxes, etc., are also exempted. it could also involve preferential pricing, for example, of some inputs and energy, or some or land that is available from the states, or also water or other inputs that go into the production. Improved general infrastructure is usually another benefit that you find commonly in free zones, and less red tape or more facilitated trade as well. So as you can see here from the chart, I've already classified these conditions and these benefits into what would make the free zone a prohibited subsidy and what could also make the free zone an actionable subsidy. And those benefits which are more or less permitted because they either escape the subsidy definition or they are not not specific. So as you can see, for example, the geographical limitations already would make this this zones a specific subsidy, so that is something that we need to watch out for. And most importantly, when you combine this with certain conditions, for example, particularly those on restrictions in, on sales into the National Customs Territory, you can already see that that this would make most of the benefits that you are receiving in the free zone a prohibited export subsidy. And that's why you see that all of those benefits that are now in the in for the free zones are in the red, so they would be prohibited subsidies. So how can you make these free zones compatible with the WTO rules? Well, the first step is to at least reduce the export subsidy component of them. So make the subsidies that are in the free zones domestic production subsidies. So in order to do that, you have to get rid of some of those conditions, particularly, as I said, the export requirements, the performance requirements, and the restrictions of sales into the National Customs Territory. And you also have to get rid of some of those benefits. So, for example, any exemption of import duties on capital goods would make it a prohibited subsidy. so you can still exempt import duties, but these duties need to be repaid upon entering the National Customs Territory. That's still okay within the rules of the WTO. However, the exemption of direct taxes, that is a subsidy. So, but since we're not combining it with any incentive to export, then it will only remain an actionable subsidy. Same with preferential pricing. So preferential pricing is, of course, a subsidy, and since it is only available within that free zone, it's a specific subsidy. So therefore, yes, it would still be an actionable subsidy. Another way that free zones can be made compatible with WTO agreements is to have, well, eliminate those exemption on direct taxes, on indirect taxes, and preferential pricing, and ask the companies in the free zones to either repay, so the import duties are still exempted, and the free zones or the companies in the free zones will have a choice when selling into the National Customs Territory of either repayment the duties on the inputs or payment of the duties on the finished product. So that would allow the companies to structure their production to take advantage sometimes of the differential that there may be in the different duties that either cover the finished product or the inputs. Or basically, free zones can be turned into a duty drawback, and that's basically just getting rid of the geographical limitations as well. So what is the S&D treatment that many countries enjoy? Well, first of all, developing countries are subject to these rules. They are subject to the prohibition on export subsidies as of 2003. Now, LDCs and Annex 7B countries are exempt from the prohibition, until graduation or export competitiveness. And who are these Annex 7 countries? These are countries with a GDP per capita of less than $1,000. So, for example, India is in that category. So, to them, that prohibition on export subsidies does not apply. As well, some developing countries obtain extensions of that transition period under Article 27.4. And this were 19 members covering 43 specific programs, out of which 13 were free zones. Who were those members? Well, they are all of these countries that you see here. And one thing that characterizes these countries is that they are small economies. One of the conditions in order to be able to receive this extension was that you would have low participation in world trade. So some of the conditions that govern this extension is that they have to be the same programs and there's a standstill on them, and they have to notify an action plan to phase out the subsidies. And when does that phase out have to be completed? Well, it has to be completed by the end of this year, because the extension was granted until 2013 with a two-year phase out. So in conclusion, as I said at the outset, many free zones can be considered to grant prohibited export subsidies. But, the idea would be that this export and import substitution incentives should be eliminated in order to decrease their exposure to challenge in the WTO dispute settlement. And by doing so, we're not getting rid of the attractiveness of the on the usefulness of these free zones. The free zones would still remain be attractive in mostly through their trade facilitation and clustering benefits that they provide, and also through those corporate social responsibility benefits that could be provided in the free zones that Anthony and Jem are going to talk to us about. So with that introduction, I leave it up to them.
Thank you very much, Raul. That's a tour de force. I ask Professor Mandel to load up his slides. I'd say that after every speaker, I'm happy to open the floor for one or two questions. So if there's one or two questions for Raul, I can take those now before the next speaker. Otherwise, we'll wait till the end and have a general discussion. So if you want to raise your hand, you can ask a question now. I would just abuse my authority as the moderator to ask a question. That, you know, it's a big tour de force. If free zones are changing, but they're not going away. You mentioned this glass house effect. Yeah, everybody has them. So it's just going to be a case where free zones have to come up with new arguments on why people should invest there, I suppose.
As I said, the arguments are not hard to find. The advantages of free zones go beyond those fiscal incentives, and many of those advantages we have seen, for example, in the growth of free zones in particular areas like Dubai, of course, in China as well, where you had a strong combination an excellent provision of services by the government, good trade facilitation measures that are being implemented in the free zones that just make the operations of the companies within the free zones a lot easier and allow them to set up their production in a way that takes advantage from some of the logistical benefits of being in a cluster with other company, and also of being able to structure their production in order to take advantage of that exemption from import duties, and how also later either pay the duties that they were exempted from on the inputs, or pay the duties on the final product.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Raul. I think that's a good segue to our next speaker, who will talk a bit about our ongoing research in this area. And as we start transition to start talking about the sustainable development potential for these areas, I think we pick up on a few of the points that Raul introduced, that the conditions for zones are changing, so we need to look at new reasons why these things exist, that zones do offer opportunities beyond fiscal incentives. There's this clustering effect. There is the efficiency of having people in a limited geographic space where government services can be perhaps a higher quality. In many developing countries, it's simply a lack of resources to be able to supply high-quality government services to people across the whole country. But if you concentrate it in a zone and you could provide higher-quality services, we can imagine that could extend to other things, to social issues, to environmental issues. So with that, I'll give the floor to Professor Bendel.
We have a question there.
Oh, there's a question. Sorry. Yeah.
Thank you for giving me the floor, and I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the interventions, but my name is Marco Sorgetti, and I'm the director of IATA, that is the International Freight Forwarders and Logistics Service Providers Federation. I think that it's also a question of connectivity and logistics connectivity, which is equally important and sometimes even more important than the tax reductions or the duties and so on. Because in many countries, we are represented in 160 countries, and unfortunately in some of them, the issue of connectivity is an issue in the sense that the services don't exist or they become extremely expensive because of the fact that competition is very limited. Mm. So I think that you could maybe appropriately highlight the fact that in some free zones, the availability of logistics services is actually enhanced and seems to be working better. Therefore, the possibility of trading becomes enhanced. Yeah. This is a pretty important point in my view.
Thank you for this intervention. I think it's an excellent point, and it illustrates what I think we're going to talk about next, which is that one of the reasons people do invest in zones is not because they're chasing lower standards or cheaper things, but they're chasing actually higher standards of logistics or other infrastructure. So,
thank you, Anthony, and delighted to be here to share with you some more detail on the UNCTAD research on export processing zones, which I've had the pleasure of being involved in. I'm a professor at a business school in the UK, focusing on corporate social responsibility. This project has been going for a few years now, and it's interesting to see that because of changes that we've just heard about with the exemptions expiring at the end of this year, I think it's a really important time to bring this research to a wider audience and get your feedback. So I'm going to go through some of the highlights of the research so far, and also I'm going to provide you my email so that if you want to see the slides, do get in touch, and I would really welcome your feedback as we take the research forward. Export processing zones and more widely special economic zones do seem to be quite popular as policy tools to promote economic development. There are over 4,000 EPZs, that's up by 3,000 from just about 20 years ago. These are a group of headlines from just the last few weeks that shows how often these free zones are in the media, with major deals being announced between governments for investments in zones. We've got Afghanistan, we've got Japan investing in Myanmar, there's news there from Oman, obviously a major deal just recently signed, about to be signed between China and Pakistan. We even see zones now in Cuba, down the bottom right there, with a Chilean investment likely in a zone there. So these are quite hot topics. Certainly enthusiasm for zones doesn't appear to be waning. But what we've heard from Raul Torres is that there is this international context of WTO trade rules, and we've seen that although there have been no complaints levied as yet, as awareness of these rules grows, it is, and also as the exemptions expire, for example, at the end of this year, for the Dominican Republic, Egypt, Guatemala, Morocco, and the Philippines, also many other countries are just slightly below the threshold of $1,000 per person GDP. It means that there is a need now to think more broadly about the grounds for future competitiveness of EPZs and SEZs, and to actually have a real open discussion about that, because I think what we're beginning to see is some politicians, some business people, some investors, some commentators suggesting that the way to maintain competitiveness is to reduce standards, not develop standards and show how zones can actually be superior in terms of logistics, in terms of offering efficient, various efficient services, including those related to labor inspections and environmental inspections and beyond. In the research that we've done, we've found that there's some existing scholarship that have shown that if a zone is based on attracting companies due to them wanting the lowest cost in terms of labor, for example, the wider benefits to the economy are quite limited, because what that does is it establishes a zone with a certain culture. It's attracting businesses that are their advantage in the market is based on being cheap. Now, that isn't going to create the right kind of culture for innovation, for agility, for being able to actually serve dynamic international markets. And that's a study done just last year by Winarczyk and the Center for Economic Research that looked at zones all over the world, and particular in-depth case study of Poland. The work that UNCTAD has been doing on corporate social responsibility that we that finds that multinational enterprises in particular over the last decade have really embraced global standards on corporate social responsibility and are expecting them to be met very much at least by their first-tier suppliers. And these are the kind of companies that are in export processing zones, so light manufacturing, for example. There are greater challenges with actually driving those standards through the supply chain down to the level of, say, farms and so on. But definitely the kind of businesses that are in export processing zones are ones that are now very much expected to meet basic national laws on labor issues, on environment, but also international standards, whether that's the sole enterprise standard or a multi-enterprise scheme on corporate social responsibility. The broader context as well, of course, is the very recent adoption by member states of the United Nations of the Sustainable Development Goals, or the Global Goals. And these differ from the Millennium Development Goals to the extent that they recognize we really must align industrialization and business development and trade with sustainability, with sustainable development. So goals 8, 9, and 12 are quite specific on that. Goal 8 being about employment and decent work, goal 9 being about sustainable production, and goal 12 being about sustainable industrialization. So that's the broader context that we've conducted our research within. And what we did was a survey of 100 export processing zones around the world. We sought to make it as international as possible to make sure that we would cover zones from the most there being in Sri Lanka and China, but all the way down to Mexico, Morocco, Namibia, and Panama. And we had the survey looked at what was being published by zones on what they offer investors and companies locating in those zones. And we had a structured survey with 63 data points that would look at the kind of services they would be offering to attract investment. I recognize now that that's quite a small sample, given the fact that there's over 4,000 zones and rapidly increasing, so that's under 3%. But we thought it would give us an interesting snapshot to see how zones are marketing themselves at present. Now, part of the survey was looking at what we might call conventional business services that are offered. So infrastructure, communications infrastructure, for example, but also assistance with customs issues, assistance with tax and processing tax, also support for business licensing. And you see there that there was quite a lot of information being provided by zones about the provision of those services. So this echoes what we've already heard, which is that many zones do seek to offer support to efficient business beyond fiscal incentives or beyond being sources of cheap labor. We also, in the survey, asked a range of, we looked for a range of information related to what we're calling sustainability-related services, so that support for environmental performance or performance on labor issues or performance on anti-corruption. And there were a few interesting ones that stood out. For example, in Uruguay, Zona America provides training on business ethics for companies and stakeholders in the zone. In Nicaragua, we saw that in the past there had been quite some industrial relations conflict in some of the zones, and so what's happened since 2010 is a tripartite agreement, which involves stakeholders, including trade unions, and that has reduced labor conflicts, and the EPZs in Nicaragua have continued to grow and thrive as a result. In Sri Lanka, we saw that the Ministry of Labor has integrated an integrated report inspection system with a multidisciplinary team of inspectors, and this can show how perhaps this idea of the fact that you can focus on a zone in a particular limited area, you can actually therefore deliver a more enhanced service, including labor, health and safety, and environmental considerations, is possible. So when we see these examples, I think this proves that it is actually possible for zones to excel if they choose to. Environmental issues we also looked at, and again, Zona America has in Uruguay has programs for reduction of the consumption of natural resources and effluent treatment. And we found that quite a few EPZs around the world have been certified to the ISO 14001 environmental management standard, and that's including locations in India and China. And some authorities, it seems, the one we found was in Kenya, have actually made ISO 14001 certification a strategic priority for all zones in Kenya, seeing that this is going to be important for their future competitiveness. And one EPZ in India that we found is actually encouraging all companies in its zone to seek ISO 14001 certification to improve practices in the zone. And what we found was particularly interesting, particularly as a lot of people, when they promote zones, say it's because we're looking at the success of China with their zones. I think what we need to understand about the success of China is how they've really sort of, in many cases, sought to curate a zone in a way which can be called a circular economy. So this is the idea that the waste products from one business can be used as the feedstuffs, the resources, the inputs to other companies in the same location. And that requires quite an active management process to attract in the certain types of firms in order to close those loops. And I thought it was quite interesting, an interview I did with Peter Lacey, who's a global managing director with Accenture. He said that EPZ agencies have the opportunity to curate a circular economy amongst firms that operate in their zone. Firms can benefit from cost savings on waste, cheaper inputs, and a higher sustainability profile in markets that seek and pay for environmental quality. So the question for us in our research is whether it's possible for zones to lead on sustainable development. It seems to be that they are. We've discovered that through our initial research. But the question then is, Are many zones recognizing that? And also, are many zones recognizing that it's the important response to the changing market environment, including what's happening with the rules at the WTO that make fiscal incentives more difficult to apply in future? So this is what we found from the survey of 100 EPZs. We found some evidence of EPZs acting on these issues and sharing that information publicly, but not all that much. So, for example, information about anti-corruption, we found very little. So that could be, say, a hotline to register complaints about corruption. I think we only found that in two cases. We found that over half did have a general policy about the environment and did mention their commitment. But when you drill down into it to actually look at what environmental services are offered, less than half are actually sharing information about environmental services that they offered, and even less were saying that they helped with making sure that environmental inspections took place. If you look at labor issues, there's even less on offer and being promoted by zones. Now, that could suggest that zones don't see it as something to attract investment at the moment, to say that they have good labor standards and they have good labor inspectorates. We think that because of the trends that we've described earlier, with growing interest from multinational enterprises in meeting basic labor standards, that actually that's a missed opportunity. For those zones that are offering such services, they need to promote them more. And for those that aren't, I think there's a strategic question here about whether they begin to see compliance with labor law and aspirations to meet international labor standards as actually something of a competitive edge in today's marketplace. We see that from existing scholarship that actually the zones, as Anthony Miller mentioned at the start, have a very mixed profile when it comes to social and environmental issues, particularly labor questions. Independent studies of zones have raised concerns, and again, I just looked on the web just for stories in the last week, and we see that there continue to be negative stories about labor practices in zones, and so this means that the positive story about zones is not being told enough, and serious concerns remain. And beyond that, perhaps serious problems remain, and therefore we think that this could be a missed opportunity for zones commercially. Also, it's a concern more broadly beyond commercial issues, just in terms of whether standards are being upheld. So I'd just like to summarize our findings. We found that most zones are offering a variety of services to help businesses, not just tax breaks, but the fiscal incentives have been key for many. And so there's a strategic challenge now, because there may be ways of trying to be WTO compliant in terms of tax drawback schemes, for example, and not distinguishing between products, whether they are exported in the end or imported into a country. But that would, if they were to remove that distinction, that would suddenly mean that companies locating in zones would have an unfair advantage competing with companies located in the same country but outside a zone. So there would be probably a bit of a backlash to that. So it's really unclear as to how compliance with these WTO rules will work out in terms of the future of fiscal incentives. And therefore, it seems very sensible, very strategically very sensible, to really develop other bases for competitive advantage, including excellence in the support for social and environmental performance. We have seen that it is possible. Some zones are doing this and doing this well. But we've also found that most surveyed zones are not communicating their environmental, social, and governance services at present. This may not mean that they are not offering them, but it's probably that they are not, and if they are, that they're not that confident, and they don't see that it means that it gives them a competitive edge at present. So what we think is that rather than a reduction of standards leading to more hassle-free business, actually an absence of standards can create hassle for multinational enterprises that seek to have a risk-free supply chain. And as Anthony Miller mentioned at the start, bad performance in a supply chain can actually damage the brand of a multinational. So we think there's an opportunity for zone owners, regulators, and stakeholders to embrace sustainability and become centers of excellence. And this can actually not just mean that we have islands of excellence in a country, but actually this will help in the transfer of knowledge and practices beyond the zone to the wider economy. So what I'd be really welcome hearing from yourselves today is feedback on these ideas before we move towards conclusions and future publication of these findings. I'd like to hear on these are some of the questions, but I'm sure you will have your own ideas on the basis of this. But how aware of the changes in trade rules concerning export subsidies are governments and zone authorities, and how are they currently responding to the context that we've described? How can we change assumptions that a patchwork of reduced standards is a route to competitiveness? We are beginning to hear this from different quarters. How do we change that and actually show that there's another way forward? How can any future regulatory changes for zones be developed in a way that doesn't reduce environmental and social standards? And what best practices should we be aware of to consider in our ongoing research? So I've put my email up there. Please do send me ideas, and also please do send me an email if you want a copy of these slides. We do want to move forward with this research, so I've put a deadline on that of 2 weeks from today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think, you know, one of the key takeaways from that is about zones being hassle-free zones. That is really what people would like, and the idea that sustainability issues, corporate social responsibility issues, they become a hassle in a world where there are increased expectations, where we look at the services. We have the very good intervention at the start about logistics services, but we see a wide range of services, whether it's information technology or power or so on. These are very conventional services, but we can imagine a lot of sustainability issues as services, providing an environment where there are inspections for labor, where there are facilities for waste treatment and so on for environment. So in that sense, there is an opportunity here to tell a new story about zones and for zones to compete in a way that is a rise to the top instead of a chase to the bottom. I'd like to now move to my colleague Claude Apocave from the ILO. He's a senior advisor for the Bureau of Workers' Activities at the ILO, and to get his reflections on our research and this line of thought. Claude?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. And since we ran out of time, I'll try to be as brief as possible. I think that for us in ILO, we've been working on export processing zones for quite a while. And over the years, we've tried to track the development of these zones. These zones are increasing in numbers. These zones are also increasing in scope. They're changing in nature also. And so it comes back to the point Raoul raised, you know, this glass house effect. Everybody's doing it, so who's going to throw the first stone? So, I mean, this, I think, is the first point one could make. The second point is that we've had three levels of concern regarding zones, and I'd just like to build my intervention around that. The first level is that zones have been built around promoting a kind of a downward spiral with respect to labor, social, and economic standards. And I think this has been a big concern for us. And that countries have been competing, and we've seen much less now, but before, with each other, saying, in our zone, we have lower wages. In our zone, we have docile workers. In our zone, we don't allow trade unions. In our zone, we don't allow strikes, you know, to attract investors. So it comes to the point made earlier that the assumption is made that by promoting lower standards, standards lower than what exists in the national economy, we think will attract investors, and we think will have high competitiveness. And this is a fundamental concern, because what then happens is that countries enter into competition with each other to propose lower and lower and lower standards. So it's really entering into a cycle of a race to the bottom. So this is the first real issue of concern for us regarding EPZs. The second area of concern is regards to the developmental impacts of EPZs. Is the enclave economy strategy the best way for kind of having a sustainable industrial strategy in a country? One of the concerns in this area has been, for instance, very often the lack of forward and backward linkages between the zone economy and the rest of the national economy. And because of restrictions on, you know, where you can source products from, restrictions on exportation and all the rest of it. So are the enclave economies helping the overall development of the economy? Another concern is in this area is on technology transfer. Is this taking place? Is there many governments engaging zones to increase employment? For us, it's not just about having a job, it's about having a decent job. And it means skills transfer. Are skills transfers been taking place? Is there a skills upgrade? But above all else, I think many countries, and I think that the literature shows that quite clearly, have to undertake kind of a cost benefit of these zones. Are these zones, you know, helpful at all? And this is particularly true for a lot of countries in Africa, where the evidence clearly shows that the zones have not really had a kind of a positive kind of developmental impact, and that when you put in a lot of resources into tax holidays, free water, free electricity, free infrastructure and stuff like that, that is a cost on taxpayers and the public finances. And you have to evaluate whether this cost has a benefit and what is the benefit of it. So I think the jury is quite out for many countries on this strategy. And I think that we probably can spend a lot of time discussing this, but it must be a concern for countries that are engaged in this strategy to see the developmental impacts of it and the developmental benefits of this. So this is also an issue that we've raised, we kind of flagged, and I ask our countries to look at. But a third area, which for us you would probably might well imagine, which is of greatest concern, is regards to labor rights and labor standards. The application of labor rights, as you know, these are internationally recognized standards. As you know, these are, we're talking about rights. We're not talking about, you know, things you do if you like. We're talking about inalienable rights of human beings. And one of the most severe forms of violations of rights has been that of the right to organize, the right to freedom of association in these zones. Now, these zones have been particularly notorious and kind of sometimes quite vicious in some countries in denial of these rights, the right to freely organize, or the workers to freely organize into trade unions or any other organization of their own choosing. And in tandem with that, the rights then to enter into dialogue with employers on their working conditions. And this has been an area of real serious concern. And in EPZ, actually, we have a concentration of violations and denial of these rights, particularly the right to organize. And in some zones, in some countries, I know, even labor inspectors, public labor inspectors, cannot enter the zones, are forbidden to enter the zones. So, I mean, this is how serious it can get. And so the zones are giving what I call a package of incentives, fiscal incentives like tax holidays and things like that. But they're also giving social incentives, no trade unions, no strikes. And this is what some countries are proposing to attract investors. So this is an area of great concern for us. But these denial of rights do not end at the level of freedom of association and collective bargaining. It also extends to other areas, you know, and like, you know, health and safety provisions. I mean, you regularly hear of factory fires and and, you know, we had a case in Bangladesh, and, you know, kind of really distressing situations. And and once you see you have zones which are zones of no rights, what happens is that you have you prepare the conditions for things like the things you've seen in some countries across the world. I mean, I was recently last week in Chinchin, we had a meeting with a group of trade unionists around global supply chains, and the delegate from Kenya was saying that workers at night were locked up in the factory. So workers are locked up. There are no unions in the factory, and workers are actually physically locked up in the factory. So what if there's a fire? You know. So these are issues of real concern for us. But another area of I think that which we have to bear in mind in the zones in terms of working conditions is regards to the relationship between the buyers and the outsourced companies in who operate in the zones. Now, there is a power relationship between the buyers and these outsourced companies. And very often, the kind of demands that are made by the big buyers on these companies are very, very stringent. And these are transferred onto the workers, you know. So, so which means excessive pressure on workers to deliver, piecemeal delivery. You have to produce so many garments per hour by the end of the day, and if you are not able to do it, you have to stay over force overtime to do it, and this means that, for as one Sri Lankan colleague trade union said the other day, the turnover is absolutely terrible because people just cannot support it, you know, cannot bear it, you know, this constant pressure to deliver. So there's a high turnover of personnel in these zones. But this high turnover is sometimes because the workers actually leave because they can't stand the pressure. But turnover is also sometimes because employment relationships are so bad that people are regularly, you know, sacked for different reasons, even because you're pregnant. You know, for a reason as simple as that. And now, there's so many countries that have made, some countries have made some progress, notably your case of Nicaragua. I know the Nicaraguan case pretty well. But even in the Nicaraguan case, you know, we still have a situation where women are being sacked from a company after they come back from maternity leave because the employers do not want to encourage the girls in the company, in the zones to pregnant. It comes to as simple as that. In fact, a couple of years ago, before being employed, some girls were people were actually going and taking pregnancy tests in some countries. So you see, we have a situation where these zones are portrayed as zones of kind of no rights or lower rights from the national economy, and this is supposed to entice investors. So on the different issues, I mean, I think that it's very, very important. I mean, we for us, it's very, very important to have a high road towards competitiveness, towards development, towards creation of employment. There's no point in putting people in conditions where they can't have skills upgrade, where they can't have we can't have a technology transfer, where we can't have a situation where people have decent work. And this is the real crux of the matter. And for the zones, one area which is particularly important, which I think you probably should integrate in your study, is the gender aspect. Most of these, in the zones, a large majority of the workers are female workers. They are young female workers. Now, this is significant. And because it has a number of implications in terms of relations in the workplace. But it also means that if you want to have zones of excellence, they must integrate issues like maternity protection, issues like providing facilities for workers with families. You know, these elements must be integrated. They must do away with, you know, things like pregnancy tests and must have a strict code on sexual harassment and things like that. So, because In many countries, in some countries, you have as many as 90% of the workforce being young female workers. So this gender aspect has to be taken on board in this analysis. So I just like to end very briefly because we're really running out of time. But I say we must. I like the idea of thinking that zones can reverse into zones of excellence. It's a great idea, you know. But maybe we can already be content with the fact that zones have the same labor and social laws as the rest of the national economy, you know. That already will be an ambition that, I mean, I would be able to accept, because in most cases, these zones are below even the standards of the national economy. So that will be a first step to try to achieve, for the zones to have to become normalized and be integrated into the national economy. And if it can become zones of excellence, fine, great, we'll welcome that. But the first step must be that these zones become a zone of excellence. And I'd like to end with a thought to that. High labor standards, and this is our experience, high labor standards lead to, in both in law and in practice, because it's not a matter of just having a law, but actually practice it. So high labor standards lead to social peace, lead to cooperation in the workplace, and that promotes high competitiveness and high development. So this is something that we must begin to get people to understand, that when you promote decent labor standards, it creates the conditions for high competitiveness and win-win situations for the workplace. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claude. I think it's a stark reminder of why we embarked on this research project, because there are a lot of problems in zones, particularly in the area of labor issues, but not only labor issues. It's also a key point that we've made a note of about the gender dimension. I've been through factories in these zones. Many zones are engaged in light manufacturing, and a lot, and you're talking about the apparel industry, you're talking about electronics industries. I've walked through these factories, and frankly, it is on the workers doing the actual work. It's about 100% women, and then there's about five or six men in the room standing on the sides who are kind of the managers, you know, watching. So it's a challenge, and there is a key gender dimension there, particularly around maternity issues. And you raise these issues about the cost-benefit of zones, and this is something that ultimately we want to address as well. And you highlight, you know, this race to the bottom. Again, that's a core piece of what we're talking about here, that, as you said, that they should take the high road. And we think that that is also not only the right thing to do, we think that there are some competitive advantages to that, because that is also what companies are looking for, what consumers are looking for. So I'd like to go quickly to Bipul Chatterjee, the Executive Director of Cuts International. Cuts International, we've had a long relationship with UNCTAD, and it is a very long, well-established NGO and active. It originated in India, but active in a number of countries around the world. They have an office here in Geneva, and they're on the forefront of working with consumers and are aware of a lot of these social issues. And so, Bipul, if I could take the floor.
Good morning, everybody. Let me first of all thank UNCTAD for organizing this session. Thanks, Anthony, for sharing it. And I also thank my co-panelists for their excellent presentations. I'm going to react to some of those points which were raised by my co-panelists, and also will make certain suggestions, including some of the answers to these questions which Jim has already posed to us. My first point is that, and I'm going to make those points based on a study which we had done a few years back on Indian ACJs. At some point of time, they are quite attractive within the policymaking circles of India, that ACJs, special economic zones or export processing zones, they are the way forward for India's economic development. I will put a question mark to such assumption or perception or whatever you call it, and I'm going to make a few particular points which I guess you have already covered in your study, but I think it will be good to go deeper into those points. My first point is that what are their contributions to the growth of manufacturing in a country? My understanding is that if I look at the history of manufacturing in my country, which is India, contribution of manufacturing to our economic growth, to our GDP, is just about 15%. And that has remained so for the last 25, 30 years, if not more. So I don't see much of a huge change of the contribution in terms of contribution of SEZs to our manufacturing growth. Of course, there are certain positive developments which have also taken place, which I'll come back to some of those points later. Second is about export promotion. Over the last 5 years, it is true that our exports have doubled, particularly after mid-2005 or so, over the last 10 years, I would say. But how much of it is due to special economic zones or export processing zones, that we really do not know. I haven't come across any authentic data-based work which has conclusively proved that it is because of SEZs or EPZs, this much of new exports which we have generated. And that's a question that we need to find answer through good methodologically sound studies. Thirdly, in terms of local economic development, there are certain positive developments which have taken place in and around SEZs, including improving their logistics. But in terms of overall economic development at the local level, I see more these SEZs or EPZs more as kind of enclaves of excellence or enclaves of prosperity, but there is not much multiplier effects at the local level as a result of SEZs. And we need to really look at these issues very deeply in order to see how we can develop those or generate those multiplier effects in order for SEZs or EPZs to be really, really beneficial towards local economic development. My fourth point is about employment generation. It is absolutely true that some new employment has been generated as a result of SEZs or EPZs. At the same time, we just cannot ignore some of the points which my previous speaker has highlighted. We need to see how labor rights, how environmental rights or environmental standards, they are being protected or encouraged in those SEZs. My observations, my feeling is that there is a long way to go. And I really like the idea of doing cost-benefit analysis of EPZs so as to see the kind of cost which the government is bearing, because particularly because of fiscal incentives, and what kind of benefits that we are getting as a result of new employment generation, not just as a result of export promotion, but as a result of new employment generation. But I also have a fundamental point which I would like to pose to my previous speaker, is that if those opportunities are not there, what would have happened to those workers? Is there any alternative livelihood opportunities that they have, which they can explore? I see that there is more and more lack of opportunities, livelihood opportunities in countries like us, and that is forcing them to go to see employment opportunities in such places, including questions such as technology transfer, skills development. These are some of the larger questions that we need to see, we need to address in order for SEZs or EPZs to be really become a successful model for their contribution to sustainable development goals, particularly the goals that Jim has already pointed out in his presentation. I have a couple of questions which I would like to pose to my co-panelist, particularly one question to Rawls. that what would have happened when those exemptions are expired. I said that by the end of 2015, those exemptions are going to expire. So are we going to see new rules more specific to SEZs or EPZs, or are you going to see a moratorium on the expiration of those exemptions? That's something many small economies, they are dependent on the SEZs or EPZs. So that's one question that we need to find answers, particularly about India, about the exemptions exceptions which India is enjoying. I think it will be more and more difficult for India to enjoy those exceptions or exemptions because our per capita GDP has already crossed $1,000 a year. So, and that is why I think there is a deep thought within the Indian establishment. So how are we going to provide incentives to SEZs, which would be WTO compatible? I know that our Commerce Ministry has commissioned a study to see to make those incentives more and more WTO compatible so that they are not challenged at the WTO. Now, let me also make some final remarks in terms of zones of excellence. I think it is possible to make them zones of excellence, including providing better logistic connectivity for facilitating their trade, not just exports. What we need to see is what kind of backward and forward linkages that these zones are developing, what kind of manufacturing, what kind of products which are being manufactured in these zones. And I really like the point which my previous speaker has made about high-level standards. They are not necessarily bad. Decent work, they're not necessarily bad in the sense that they can indeed lead to higher competitiveness. At the end of the day, why all these incentives are being given to make them more competitive? And I think, I believe that high-level standards can indeed lead to higher competitiveness and also better market access because consumer preference, they are changing. Consumers are becoming more and more aware of products which are being produced and how they are being produced, not just what are the products, but how they are being produced, what are their impact on environmental issues, what are the impact on labor issues and things like that. In one of our studies on the textiles and clothing sector of India, which we did about 2 years ago, we found that those firms, it was firm-based work, those firms which are adhering to higher environmental standards, we didn't look into labor standards in that study, but those who are adhering to higher environmental standards, they are also getting better market access in their export markets, particularly in the West. And they are very categorical in telling us that they are interested in investing in environmental protection, in adhering to higher environmental standards, in order to have more certainty, business certainty, in their export markets in particular. So I think SEZs or EPZs, they can be made zones of excellence. They can be made compatible with SDGs, particularly those three SDGs. But there is a long way to go. And there is a lot of awareness generation, and I think UNCTAD is rightly placed to make our governments aware about the cost as well as benefits of SEZs or EPZs and how they can be made more of center of excellence rather than we keep hearing that they are kind of race to the bottom kind of strategies that our governments are following. So I think this study which UNCTAD has just done, I think it's a good study, and perhaps it is going to raise more questions than finding answers to those questions. But it is important to raise those questions. Unless we acknowledge our problems, I don't think that we are going to find solutions to those problems. So I thank UNCTAD for doing this study and for organizing this session. And hopefully this will lead to more debates on this subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I took a number of notes when you were speaking. I think these are all key points. It's also about how, I mean, we talk about these as zones of excellence, and potentially they could be that. But, of course, it is also how you transfer that to the rest of the society. Picking up, of course, on Claude's point about the cost-benefit analysis, there has to be more about that, how it impacts the rest of the country. You're absolutely right that more work needs to be done in this space, and more work needs to be done by the zones. In our study of the zones, we found, it, as Professor Bendel pointed out, we found it's a minority of zones that are typically doing these things, or at least talking about them, but we still found it interesting that there were any, frankly, and that is a, if you should think of it as a proof of concept. So it's possible. So you could do it. So you could scale this up, and hopefully we can, this is an exploratory paper, we're exploring a new idea, and as Bipal just mentioned that, you know, in India that policymakers are looking for new incentives, new ways to attract investment, hopefully we can create a new idea in this space. I'd like to welcome your questions for anybody in the panel, yes?
Thank you, I'm from China. What I want to say is barely a question, but it's a notion from what I have learned and experienced in China. I agree that the special zone, they want to attract investment and also low cost. But another very important function nowadays happened in China in a special zone is that the government want to, how to say, it's a kind of a zoo where government can learn new rules. They can try new rules, like what happened in Shanghai. The government use a negative list of investment. That means the government wants to open up, but with cautions, so they can trial. They can make trial in the special zoo. So I think that's a very important new function of this kind of zoo, in addition to the old and also traditional functions the zoo has. That's my point.
Okay,
thank you.
That's an important point. We'll come back to that question here.
Thank you. I'm from Zambia. I'm a member of parliament. And I chair the Committee on Labor in our parliament. I totally agree with the speaker from ILO in terms of the abuse of workers in these zones. But I've got a question to you, sir. Most of these countries in which these zones are members of ILO, and they have conventions that they've ratified and that they should be observing in the countries. Now, what is ILO's stand in terms of these zones? Are they exempted from observing these conventions that the host countries have signed? And in your opinion, who should we be holding accountable? Is it the zones or the host governments in this, you know, this vice which is so rampant in most of these zones? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take a couple more questions and we'll go to the panel. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, it's a plea and it's a recommendation, and it refers to the intervention we just heard from China. In particular, in the issue of Shanghai special arrangements, we would be recommending that information is disseminated timely, and also to the outside world, because we experienced in that situation some uncertainty around the world on some of the rules, especially with regards to VAT. You probably have heard about these things. And then our federation in China had become very active, and I thank them very much for the work that had been done. But it is really important that when these experiments start, information is provided not only for the local operators, but as well for the rest of the world, because by definition, these export and import special zones are trading places that deal with most of the world, and it's very important that we know the rules also outside. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. I think that's a key point. I mean, in our study, we were looking at publicly available information, and a lot of times they're not providing that. Okay, let's just wrap up with some comments from the panel. I mean, there was a direct question from Zambia to the ILO, so Claude, I ask you to field that.
Well, thank you so much.
Briefly?
Yes. Whether the zones are exempted? No, the zones are not exempted. The whole point of having our conventions and our standards is that to ensure a level playing field across the world, below which no one will fall. It's a level playing field to ensure humane working conditions for all. And because we know from experience that if we don't have that, there will be competition between countries, and the competition will not go upwards, it will go downwards. So these convention zones are not excluded from ILO standards, the responsibility falls on the government to make sure that the laws, national laws, are applied in the zones. And we've seen that many countries, they say that the national law applies in law, but in the practice, in the actual practice, these laws are implemented. And in some countries, even public governmental, government-owned labor inspectors cannot enter the zones. So this is the problem. So zones are not exempted, and the responsibility falls on governments to apply the law.
Okay, I think that's quite a clear point. I think, you know, one thing in my work in the past, the previous incarnation, I worked with the High Commission on Human Rights, and there was a distinction between in terms of applying the law and protecting people's rights, between governments who willfully do not do it and governments who would like to do it but simply lack the resources to do it. And I think there's two different things there. In the case of governments who would like to do it to make sure that these rights are protected but lack the resources, one of the things that we're discussing in this thing about zones is that if in this concentrated area, it can perhaps be more efficient, and it can be part of the zone fees for companies that are going there to help offset the cost of labor inspectors and so on. So maybe...
Just one last point. I just want to add to that. Yes, the government responsibility protects, but also there's the company's responsibility to respect human rights.
Yeah,
absolutely. So this is also important. Yeah. Company's responsibility. And that cuts across... So for multinationals who have outsourced their production across their supply chain, it's also their responsibility to ensure that throughout the supply chain, including that their local subsidiary or the outsourced company also respects workers' rights, respects national law.
That's a key point. No, that's a key point, Claude. Thanks for making that. Okay, so we're standing between you and your coffee break. I'm just one last intervention, the question from China. I had the privilege of working in the free zone in Pudong once, and I'm very impressed with the way it operated, and I had a chance to meet a few government officials. It is true that zones do offer this opportunity to be a laboratory for governments to experiment, and we've certainly seen that in China with their eco-cities and so on. I just wanted to ask Professor Bendel if he had any brief comments on the experimentation in China and the evolution of zones over time.
Yeah, I think it's a good point because it also relates to the question I pose there, which is how can any future regulatory changes to zones be developed in ways that don't reduce social or environmental standards? There are challenges that businesses find in certain economies and that the governments could respond seeing a zone as a laboratory. For example, restrictions on foreign ownership and variety of other issues like that, which aren't about labor standards, aren't about environmental performance. And so I think maybe there needs to be an inquiry into whether some guidance can be given for pro-competitiveness regulatory innovations in zones, treating it as a laboratory, but which do not undermine social or environmental standards and performance. And, of course, if that is to be done, responding to also what we've heard from Vipal earlier, is that we need to analyze whether such innovations do actually merit that they do actually deliver a wider economic development, whether actually there's more of a cost to a benefit from that kind of innovation.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you all for your time, and enjoy the rest of the public forum.